Ascent Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Confidence by Harvard Business Review, narrated by Anne Sprinkle and Joshua Saxon. 1. How to Build Confidence by Amy Gallo. Very few people succeed in business without a degree of confidence. Yet everyone, from young people in their first real jobs to seasoned leaders in the upper ranks of organizations, have moments or days, months, or even years when they are unsure of their ability to tackle challenges. No one is immune to these bouts of insecurity at work, but they don't have to hold you back. What the experts say. Confidence equals security, equals positive emotion, equals better performance, says Tony Schwartz, the president and CEO of The Energy Project and the author of Be Excellent at Anything, The Four Keys to Transforming the Way We Work and Live. And yet, he concedes that insecurity plagues consciously or subconsciously every human being I've met. Overcoming this self-doubt starts with honestly assessing your abilities and your shortcomings, and then getting comfortable enough to capitalize on and correct them, adds Deborah H. Grenfeld, the Mogadam Family Professor of Leadership and Organizational Behavior and co-director of the Executive Program for Women Leaders at Stanford Graduate School of Business. Here's how to do that and get into the virtuous cycle that Schwartz describes. Prepare. Your piano teacher was right. Practice does make perfect. The best way to build confidence in a given area is to invest energy in it and work hard at it, says Schwartz. Many people give up when they think they're not good at a particular job or task, assuming the exertion is fruitless. But Schwartz argues that deliberate practice will almost always trump natural aptitude. If you are unsure about your ability to do something, speak in front of a large audience, negotiate with a tough customer, start by trying out the skills in a safe setting. Practice can be very useful and is highly recommended because, in addition to building confidence, it also tends to improve quality. Actually deliver the big presentation more than once before the due date. Do a dry run before opening a new store, says Grunfeld. Even people who are confident in their abilities can become more so with better preparation. Get out of your own way. Confident people aren't only willing to practice, they're also willing to acknowledge that they don't and can't know everything. It's better to know when you need help than not, says Grunfeld. A certain degree of confidence, specifically confidence in your ability to learn, is required to be willing to admit that you need guidance or support. On the flip side, don't let modesty hold you back. People often get too wrapped up in what others will think to focus on what they have to offer, says Katie Orenstein, founder and director of The Op-Ed Project, a nonprofit that empowers women to influence public policy by submitting opinion pieces to newspapers. When you realize your value to others, confidence is no longer about self-promotion, she explains. In fact, confidence is no longer the right word. It's about purpose. Instead of agonizing about what others might think of you or your work, concentrate on the unique perspective you bring. Get feedback when you need it. While you don't want to completely rely on others' opinions to boost your ego, Validation can also be very effective in building confidence. Grunfeld suggests asking someone who cares about your development as well as the quality of your performance to tell you what she thinks. Be sure to pick people whose feedback will be entirely truthful. Grunfeld notes that when performance appraisals are only positive, we stop trusting them. And then use any genuinely positive commentary you get as a talisman. Also remember that some people need more support than others, so don't be shy about asking for it. The White House Project finds, for example, that many women need to be told they should run for office before deciding to do so. Men do not show this pattern of needing others' validation or encouragement, says Grunfeld. It's okay if you need praise. Take risks. Playing to your strengths is a smart tactic, but not if it means you hesitate to take on new challenges. Many people don't know what they're capable of until they are truly tested. Try things you don't think you can do. Failure can be very useful for building confidence, says Grunfeld. Of course, this is often easier said than done. It feels bad to not be good at something. There's a leap of faith with getting better at anything, says Schwartz. But don't assume you should feel good all the time. In fact, stressing yourself is the only way to grow. Enlisting help from others can make this easier. Grunfeld recommends asking supervisors to let you experiment with new initiatives or skills when the stakes are relatively low, and then to support you as you tackle those challenges. Principles to remember. Do, be honest with yourself about what you know and what you still need to learn. Practice doing the things you are unsure about. Embrace new opportunities to prove you can do difficult things. Don't focus excessively on whether or not you have the ability. Think instead about the value you provide. Hesitate to ask for external validation if you need it. Worry about what others think. Focus on yourself, not a theoretical and judgmental audience. Case study number one. Get the knowledge and get out of your own way. In 2010, Mark Angelo was asked by the CEO of Hospital for Special Surgery in New York to create and implement a program to improve quality and efficiency. Mark was relatively new to the organization. He had worked as a business fellow for the previous year, but had recently taken on the role of Director of Operations and Service Lines. Even though he had background in the operations strategy from his days as a management consultant, he was not familiar with the Lean Six Sigma principles he'd need to use for this project, and didn't feel equipped to build the program from scratch. He was particularly concerned he wouldn't be able to gain the necessary support from the hospital's physicians and nurses. What would they think of a young administrator with no hospital experience telling them how to improve quality and increase efficiency? For 5 months, Mark struggled to get the project on track, and his confidence suffered. He knew that his apprehension was in part due to his lack of knowledge of Six Sigma. He read a number of books and articles on the subject, talked to consultants who specialized in it, and spoke with hospitals that had been successful in developing and implementing similar programs. This helped, but he realized he still didn't know if he would be able to get the necessary people on board. I was anxious and stressed because I had no idea how I was going to transform the organization. I knew I couldn't do it on my own. It was going to take a collective effort that included our management team and all of our staff, he said. He talked with the CEO, who had supported him since the beginning. He also looked to his family for emotional support. Through these conversations, he realized that his anxiety stemmed from a desire to be liked by his colleagues and therefore to avoid conflict. After many discussions with my CEO and observing how he handled these situations, I learned that it is better to strive to be well-respected than well-liked, he said. This was a turning point for Mark. Instead of worrying so much about what others thought of him, he focused on doing what was best for the patient and the institution. In December, he presented the vision for the program to the entire medical staff. While he was nervous about how it would be received, he knew this was a critical moment. I was able to get up in front of one of our toughest constituencies and present the vision that we had been developing over the past few months, he says. His presentation was met with applause. In the end, my confidence grew by leaps and bounds, and we were able to design a program that has since taken off with great success across the hospital. I was able to overcome my mental blocks and knowledge deficits to build a program that will truly help transform how we approach performance improvement and patient care, he says. Case study number 2. Know the value you bring. Julie Zhu knew she had things to say, but she wasn't sure how to get heard. As a product design manager at Facebook, she had developed valuable expertise in the products she worked on. Yet, she lacked the confidence to share her ideas. She was used to being one of very few women in the room. That had been the case when she was studying computer science at Stanford, and it was still true now that she was at Facebook. She knew this meant she needed to make a concerted effort to speak up. But being the minority voice wasn't the only reason she felt unsure of herself. She says that she also suffered from imposter syndrome, feeling as if she hadn't earned a right to her ideas, that she had somehow ended up where she was accidentally, not through hard work. Julie was intrigued when someone in HR told her about a workshop offered at Stanford by the Op-Ed Project. After attending and getting positive feedback about her ideas, Julie tried something she had never thought to do before. Write an op-ed. In November 2010, she published a piece in the New York Times entitled, Where Anonymity Breeds Contempt, about the danger of anonymity in online discussions. It was a matter of someone saying, "You can do it," she explains. It had never occurred to me that I could be published, but it actually wasn't hard at all. The reaction she got in the workshop and afterward back at Facebook boosted her confidence. Since then, she's gotten a lot of support from colleagues, which has emboldened her to speak her mind. Of course, it's still a work in progress, but now I'm a much more confident speaker and writer, she says. 2. Overcome the 8 Barriers to Confidence by Rosabeth Moss Cantor. To get a more confident you, or a more confident company, community, family, or team, first know what gets in the way. The best resolutions will go nowhere without the confidence to stick with them. Confidence is an expectation of a positive outcome. It is not a personality trait, It is an assessment of a situation that sparks motivation. If you have confidence, you're motivated to put in the effort, to invest the time and resources, and to persist in reaching the goal. It's not confidence itself that produces success. It's the investment and the effort. Without enough confidence, it's too easy to give up prematurely or not get started at all. Hopelessness and despair prevent positive action. To muster the confidence to work toward your goals, avoid these 8 traps. Self-defeating assumptions. You think you can't, so you don't. A British Olympic runner is so rattled by a misstep that cost her a contest that she dropped out of the next event. A company team decides that a popular world leader is so far out of their league that they don't invite him to speak at their customer event. Talented women sometimes leave before they leave, as Sheryl Sandberg puts it, assuming that they won't be promoted or succeed when they have children, so they start behaving like they're departing years before departure, thus foreclosing their options. It's one thing to be realistic. It's another to behave like a loser before entering the game. Goals that are too big or too distant. I know how often leaders say they want to tackle BHAGs, big, hairy, audacious goals. But having only enormous goals can actually undermine confidence. The gap between a giant goal and today's reality can be depressing and demotivating. Confidence comes from small wins that occur repeatedly, with each small step moving you closer to the big goal. But the small steps must be valued and turned into goals themselves. Winners think small as well as big. Declaring victory too soon. This is the dieter's dilemma. You lose the first few pounds and feel so good that you reward yourself with chocolate cake. Then when the pounds go back on, you feel so discouraged that you have more cake to feel better. I saw this pattern in a college football team that was coming off a 9-year losing streak. Yes, 9 years. After winning its first game in nearly a decade, a team member shouted, "Now we'll win the championship!" First, of course, they had to win the next game, which they didn't. Step-by-step discipline builds confidence. Do-it-yourselfing. It's a trap to think you can go it alone, without a support system, and without supporting others. Losing teams have stars, but they focus on their own records, not how well the whole team does. The resulting resentments and inequalities provoke internal battles that drag everyone down. To build your confidence, think about building the confidence of others and creating a culture in which everyone is more likely to succeed, whether through mentoring them or recognizing their strengths. Giving to others boosts happiness and self-esteem, as numerous research studies show. Supporting them makes it easier to ensure that they support you. Blaming someone else. Confidence rests on taking responsibility for one's own behavior. Even in difficult circumstances, we have choices about how to respond to adversity. Whining about past harms reduces confidence about future possibilities. When the blame game is carried out within companies, everyone loses confidence, including external stakeholders. Confidence is the art of moving on. Defensiveness. It's one thing to listen and respond to critics. It's another to answer them before they've done anything. Don't defend yourself if you're not being attacked. Apologize for your mistakes, but don't apologize for who or what you are. Instead, take pride in where you've come from and lead with your strengths. Neglecting to anticipate setbacks. Confidence involves a dose of reality. It is not blind optimism, thinking that everything will be fine no matter what. Confidence stems from knowing that there will be mistakes, problems, and small losses en route to big wins. After all, even winning sports teams are often behind at some point in the game. Confidence grows when you look at what can go wrong, think through alternatives, and feel you are prepared for whatever might happen. Overconfidence. Confidence is a sweet spot between despair and arrogance. Don't let confidence slip over into the arrogant end. Overconfidence is the bane of economies. For example, the irrational exuberance that preceded the global financial crisis. Corrupt leaders who assume they're so necessary that they won't get into trouble for a small expense account fudge, or individuals who swagger and feel entitled to success rather than working for it. Arrogance and complacency lead to neglect of the basics, deaf ears to critics, and blindness to the forces of change, a trap for companies as well as individuals. Sure enough, like the old proverb, "Pride goeth before a fall," the slide into a losing streak often begins with a winning streak. A little humility goes a long way to moderate arrogance and keep just the right amount of confidence. Remember, it's not enough just to feel confident. You have to do the work. But with an expectation of success, you can try new things, form new partnerships, contribute to shared success, and revel in small wins that move you toward bigger goals.
3. Everyone suffers from imposter syndrome. Here's how to handle it. By Andy Malinsky. One of the greatest barriers to moving outside your comfort zone is the fear that you're a poser, that you're not worthy, that you couldn't possibly be qualified to do whatever you're aiming to do. It's a fear that strikes many of us. Imposter syndrome. I know I've certainly had those thoughts while publishing pieces of writing, whether it's blogs or books. I've had them while teaching my first university classes and giving speeches to corporate audiences. I appear confident on the outside, but feel deeply insecure on the inside, wondering who I am to be stepping up to this stage. What could I possibly have to say that anyone would want to hear? And I'm not alone. Actress and Harvard alum Natalie Portman described the self-doubt she experienced as a Harvard student in a poignant commencement speech several years ago. "I felt like there had been some mistake," she said, "that I wasn't smart enough to be in this company, and that every time I opened my mouth, I would have to prove that I wasn't just a dumb actress." Howard Schultz, the former executive chairman and CEO of Starbucks, revealed that he and CEOs he knows feel the same way. "Very few people, whether you've been in that job before or not, get into the seat and believe today that they are now qualified to be the CEO. They're not going to tell you that, but it's true." What can you do to overcome these feelings of inadequacy that so many of us experience? A first tip is something that Portman highlights in her Harvard address, which I found quite helpful. Recognize the benefits of being a novice. You might not realize it, but there are great benefits to being new in your field. When you are not steeped in the conventional wisdom of a given profession, you can ask questions that haven't been asked before or approach problems in ways others haven't thought of. It's no surprise, for example, that some of the best research ideas I get as a professor come from undergraduate students with little previous experience, people who can think with a fresh outsider's perspective. This is true in business as well. The pharmaceutical company Eli Lilly has created a crowdsourcing platform called Innocentive, through which outside innovators are paid to solve vexing problems the company faces. And it works. In fact, according to a study by Kareem Lakhani of Harvard Business School, many problems are solved by those from outside the field in question, physicists solving chemistry problems, for example. So the next time you feel inadequate in a particular domain, remember that as an outsider to the role in question, you might have the most critical perspective of all. A second tip for combating imposter syndrome is to focus more on what you're learning than on how you're performing. According to psychologist Carol Dweck, the feelings that imposter syndrome leaves you with are ones we might actually be able to control. With a performance mindset, which people suffering from imposter syndrome often have, you tend to see your feelings of inadequacy or the mistakes you make as evidence of your underlying limitations. This mindset only fuels the concerns you have about being unfit for your job. But there's something you can work to cultivate instead, a learning mindset. From this perspective, your limitations are experienced quite differently. Your mistakes are seen as an inevitable part of the learning process rather than as more evidence of your underlying failings. That brings us to the third tip. Understand the power of perspective. Those of us who experience imposter syndrome often feel like we're the only ones feeling this way, but reality is very different. Early in my career, when I walked into a networking event, I was convinced that I was the only one worried about making small talk with strangers. But over time, I've realized that practically everyone in the room shares that same concern. According to a recent survey by Vantage Hill Partners, being found incompetent is the number one fear of executives worldwide. So if you're feeling like an imposter, chances are that others in your situation feel the exact same way. Or as Tina Fey once quipped, "I've realized that almost everyone is a fraud, so I try not to feel too bad about it." It may not be easy, but overcoming imposter syndrome is possible. You don't need to feel helpless or alone. Next time you're in a situation that feels completely outside your comfort zone, don't focus on your failures. Consider it your opportunity to learn from your missteps and to bring forth a new perspective that others may not have. 4. Mental Preparation Secrets of Top Athletes. An interview with Daniel McGinn by Sarah Green Carmichael. Sarah Green Carmichael. Welcome to the HBR IdeaCast from Harvard Business Review. I'm Sarah Green Carmichael. To get psyched up for the big game, sports teammates give each other pep talks, listen to an exciting song during warm-ups, or follow a particular pregame routine. Then there's a locker room speech, often dramatized in popular movies, like the following, from Herb Brooks in the film Miracle, where the coach inspires individuals to greatness. "I'm sick and tired of hearing about what a great hockey team the Soviets have. Screw them. This is your time. Now go out there and take it." But what's the business equivalent of the pep talk? When you have a big presentation, job interview, quarter-ending sales meeting, or situation where you really need to be on, how do you prepare for it? If you're like a lot of people, you probably think about what you're going to say and what you're going to wear, and then you just kind of, well, show up. HBR senior editor Dan McGinn thinks we can all do better than that by taking a cue from how the best athletes and performers prepare. He's the author of the article, The Science of Pep Talks, in the July-August 2017 issue of Harvard Business Review, and he is also the author of the book Psyched Up, How the Science of Mental Preparation Can Help You Succeed. Dan, thank you for joining us today. Daniel McGinn. Thank you, Sarah. So, did you have to get psyched up to write this book? I did, actually. Writing this book did change the way I get ready to perform my job as a writer every morning or many mornings. If you watch sports, you become pretty accustomed to seeing the athletes and what they do when they warm up. They tend to have headphones on, and you know that they're listening to a certain set of songs. It's not just up to chance. You're used to seeing locker room speeches. You're used to seeing that gaze, that locked-in look that they have, and that focus. And they're taught to do that. There are sports psychologists who teach them exactly what they should be thinking about before a game. The argument I have is that more of our jobs are like that these days. It's less like factory work where you're doing the same thing every day and more about the big pitch, the presentation, the sales call, and that we should learn to do what these athletes do to try to lock ourselves in. I think about coming into my job every day and that maybe we should run through the halls and give every editor a high five and then chew a pen and then put the pen back in the bin or other crazy things. How feasible is it to do some of these things on a daily basis? Yeah, obviously, if our boss Addy Ignatius gave us a speech like Knut Rockne did before we sat down to edit articles, we would all think it was kind of crazy. If you don't know who that is, Rockne was the legendary Notre Dame foot.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?